All right, we are back. Anticipating the noon whistle here any minute. And you've got it tuned to 104.3 and 104.7 KHOM. Cotton Eureka Arcata, streaming and podcasting on the web at khum.com, which is made possible by the Stream Guys translator K282AD Ferndale. And joining me now here in the studio are brothers Nate Jackson and D'Angelo Jackson. How's it going, guys?
Good. How are you doing?
Great.
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for coming. And I just wanted to give a little backstory on Nate and D'Angelo. D'Angelo is visiting from out of the area, but he's been up here visiting his family before and had some unfortunate interactions with local police. And then Nate actually is a Humboldt County resident. Both of them, would I say, you guys are people of color in our community. And they're here to talk and give their perspective on how that has affected their interactions with local police officers. Can we start with maybe talking about both of you have unfortunate stories about your that's the noon whistle. That's really loud, huh? Happens every day. That's the noon whistle. Nate, do you want to start? You live here locally. Do you want to start off telling your story about some encounters that you've had with local police?
Yes. Yep. So, like she said, I've been living in Humboldt for about 7-8 years on and off. And I've had a few run-ins with the police that I feel like I've been racially profiled, and unfortunately, every encounter has ended me either in court, and so I think there's a lot of tension, especially with the ongoing stuff, and just people kind of need to, I think, kind of open their eyes and realize that just because they might not be actually seeing it every day for themselves, that it's still going on. It's still pretty relevant here, and so I'm here to open and talk about stuff that's been I think this community needs to hear. And
so you have a specific story that I heard about where you were arrested during the farmers market on the Arcata Plaza. Is that correct?
About several years ago, like 2 years ago, I had a spliff in my ear, and I was turned around by a police officer and put on the ground in handcuffs, and rolled up for less than an ounce of marijuana for a spliff in my ear that, you know, I had no intention on smoking in the plaza or anywhere around there. And this was before the new ordinance was even put into place. And so I went to court and tried to fight it and lost, you know, like usual. But that was just one of a few incidents that I feel like I was definitely profiled.
And D'Angelo is joining us. You live in Marin County, but you come up and visit your family up here pretty frequently.
Yeah.
And you have a pretty crazy story about an encounter with the Eureka Police Department, right? What was your encounter like with them?
Well, my encounter was quite traumatizing. I was getting gas set in Eureka, and all of a sudden, I believe 2 to 3 officers pulled into the gas station behind my car where I was parked at the pump. And one of the officers walked up to the car and told me to get out of the car. So I complied. They put me in handcuffs, and they said I fit the description of a bank robber or a gas station robber or something of the sort. But at the time, I was with my father, who was a corrections officer, and he was following behind me, so he had pulled up in the gas station right as this was commencing. And he stepped out the car, pulled out his badge, and asked what was going on. And that's when the officers kind of stepped back and realized that I wasn't a thug. They had the wrong person. They profiled me because I was like, I look like an out-of-towner, I guess. The commanding officer told the other officer to step back. They became more respectful when they saw my father was a corrections officer. They clearly saw that I wasn't who they were looking for. So at the end of the confrontation, they gave me a card and said the FBI to be in contact with me and sent me on my way.
Did the FBI ever call you?
No, never. I mean, I was waiting for them to call me because I would take them to court and sue because it's really traumatizing. I'm
like, I can only imagine. And, you know, I feel like this is what is affecting both of you as citizens in our community is also affecting me. This really, really bothers me that this is happening in our community. You were telling me about how you have like changed the way that you think about driving around, like you were carrying around your license up in your visor because you were afraid when you got pulled over by the police that you wanted to be able to make sure that they saw your hands at all time. And the whole idea that people of color are thinking about this kind of stuff, and literally and rightfully so, they're literally terrified of these encounters that they're having with police officers, and it seems to be affecting the news that's going on, and people are now. It's not that this hasn't been going on for a long time. I recognize that this police brutality and institutional racism has been going on since we had a caller that called in. She's Native American, mentioned that this has been going on since the beginning of civilization, as soon as people came over from Europe and started settling here in this country. And I'm wondering how at the Black and Blue Dialogue, which neither of you unfortunately were able to attend, but I do have lots of notes and I do plan on posting those up at the K-Home Facebook page if you want to read my notes from the Black and Blue Dialogue. There was a question that was posed to the panel of students and faculty. There was law enforcement there as well. And it was, how is these things becoming more covered in the news? Like, how do these stories affect you? And how is it changing anything about you and how you are functioning within society?
Yes.
And how is it changing you?
You kind of get into like, especially when you're driving to like a survival mode, you really start thinking about, you know, what if I don't make it home? What if I run into the wrong police officers having a bad day? And all these thoughts, I mean, when you drive, let alone you think about getting into an accident, but then you have to add on these other things, getting pulled over and it escalating into a situation where you never see your family again over a traffic stop or a broken taillight or, you know, anything like that. And it makes you really stressed to think that everything could end over something so petty when all you have to do is communicate. And it really stresses you out.
I bet that's really stressful. I'm sorry, this really, really bothers me. And I'm really grateful that you guys were able to come and talk with me about these issues, because it is really, I walked away from the Black and Blue Dialogue just feeling like so incredibly sad. Just knowing how much fear is being instilled in the African American community because of these recent or not even so recent, because of what's going on between tension between the police and Black people and community members and Black people. There was someone who was talking about going to class. She is a child development major at the Black and Blue Dialogue, and she was talking about how there was only one other person of color in her major, and going to class was really difficult for her because there are some of her friends and some of her classmates are like huge Donald Trump supporters, and that was completely distracting her from studying in school, and that it gave she was not only getting fear from the police, but from her friends and other citizens in the community. Do you guys feel that too?
Yes, it's Donald Trump has, you know, made people believe that these feelings of hatred are okay. Hatred against women, hatred against Mexicans, hatred against Muslims, these things are not okay. No hate is okay. And, you know, Trump is a leader. He's trying to lead our country. and people are looking for a leader, but he's bringing out negative emotions that should really be gotten rid of. You know, he's bringing up feelings that people have that we need to work and communicate and get rid of. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's like a dormant disease.
Yeah, someone had it actually, I feel like, very eloquently described, I think, what you're talking about at this particular dialogue as unintentional ignorance.
Exactly.
And I agree. Like, it seems like we are starting to wake up to the idea that there is so much hate riding in the hearts of so many Americans towards not only Black people, but Mexican people, Muslim people, there, women. You know, there's all of this hate, and I wonder what we can, as communities, I feel like it's got to start within our community. What can we as communities do to get rid of that hate?
We need to talk to each other as humans. You know, one-on-one, we're all humans, we all share Earth. And if we don't communicate with each other, we'll destroy each other. And it's all about communication. You know, fear of the unknown is normal. It's natural. And there's people out here that want to conquer and divide. They want to separate us. They want Blacks hating whites, whites hating Blacks, everybody hating each other. And who wins? We all lose. You know, and none of us can come together and help each other. So we have to come together as a whole. All of us, stop hating. I don't care if you're Black hating white people, white hating Mexicans, Native Americans. It's hate will kill you from the inside before it kills the people you hate.
That's true. That's very true. And I feel like, okay, so I am, just a little backstory on me, I am probably perceived as being a white female. I have Hispanic blood and Jewish blood, so Cuban and Jewish, Juban, which Cubans and Jewish people both, they have a history of overcoming a lot of adversity, and I was raised by white people, so I feel like I am perceived by most people within the community as being a white female. And I know I can't speak on behalf of all white females, but there's something that I have noticed, and that something is that maybe it seems like it might be a little difficult for white people in general, and again, I'm generalizing, to open up a dialogue with Black people about these biases that have infiltrated, you know, our society. What do you have to say about that? Do you feel like there are a lot of people who try to open, white people who try to open up these dialogues with you?
No, it is rare. Like, you inviting us here to do this, I feel like it's a blessing. It's a rarity, and we need more platforms like this. You know, one person can change the world. And by you providing us a platform, I haven't been able in all these years to voice this to anybody. And being able to speak with somebody who understands, who's on the other side of the fence, who sees both sides, is very, is priceless to me. And I believe that we just need more opportunities like this, like what you have in your show, which is beautiful.
Well, yeah, and just even, I don't know, like, obviously not all conversations between white people and Black people or white people and Native American people are going to take place on the radio, right?
Right.
And, you know, and there are some people, I feel like in Humboldt, you know, I'm from the South. There are a lot more Black people living in the South. Mm-hmm. I feel like I had a lot more friends that were of color in all kinds of, you know, there are a lot more Cuban people living in the South. There's just like a huge melting pot down here. And Humboldt feels very, very white to me. And I feel like there aren't so many people that I know that are friends other than, you know, you guys that are actually African Americans. And I feel like, you know, how do you open up a dialogue with Black people? Do you have to, I think maybe white people might feel like they're they're not being culturally sensitive, or I don't really know where it's coming from, but would you feel offended if just some stranger approached you on the street and was like, you know, this has been bothering me, can we talk about this, or can I get your perspective on this, or what's a way to open up a dialogue for people?
That would be, to me, I perceive that as reaching out. That's great. I mean, if a white man came and asked me, how do I feel about it? I'd be like, he has heart. He wants to talk about this. He is not trying to sweep it under the rug. He wants to resolve it and find a solution. And I would respect that.
What do you feel like are some solutions? Like, what could we be doing? Should we be hosting more of these, like what was going on campus, these dialogues between law enforcement and members of people of color in our community?
Yes, that's great. Dialogue, everything begins with dialogue, I believe. If you cut dialogue out of the equation, then it's simply tactics and, you know, actions that we usually regret. But we could talk things over and figure out a solution.
And what would, yeah, so what's the dialogue to the solution? So we're having a dialogue right now. What do you think that we need to realize as a society, as a community? What solutions are we going to come to help end this racial bias, these things that are seated, this hate that is seated, that we're recognizing through Donald Trump is like, you know, kind of bringing it up, bring it right to our attention, that there's a lot of this that's happening. There's a lot of it that exists in our country. So how do we change that bias? How do we address that bias? What do we do in a solution oriented manner?
I think the police on a lower level need to really get involved in the communities that are the poor communities. They need to get on the street. They need to talk to people. They need to get involved with, you know, whether it be, they need to involve themselves with the people on the street. They can't just sit in a car driving by being disconnected from reality. They have to get out there and really associate with people, and not just in a authoritarian manner, but on a human to human personal level. You know, so people can make that connection, you know, whether it's through sports, music, there has to be community interaction.
Like some kind of interaction other than police being on the street and interacting with community only when they're on patrol.
Right.
Or when they're trying to enforce this order via the law.
Exactly.
So there was something that was brought up again at the Black and Blue Dialogue that was addressing the idea of the blue code of silence. And one of the officers mentioned that the culture of policing is affected by the idea that people change once they get hired, and they start to feel closer to other officers than they do in the community. And you guys grew up, your father's corrections officer.
Right.
Do you feel, so you kind of have a little bit of insight into both realities of that. And did your father express to you this idea of the blue code of silence and how that affects the way that people are, the way people interact with their community versus their coworkers?
Yes, you know, pretty much 75% of policemen are heroes. But there's like a 25% that are rogue policemen that, you know, there's nothing's perfect. You have policemen that do bad things. So my father, he would tell me, his friends, they would do things that weren't, you know, they would be considered
unethical.
And he, you know, it's like you have the blue code of silence is basically friendship. You know, you work with these people, you save each other's lives, you protect each other. And so there's a camaraderie like in the army. So it's like, you know, that has a lot to do with it. Just the common camaraderie of putting your life on the line every day for each other. That is part of it. But then there's another aspect of it where some officers, you know, are just, they don't have it all. And, you know, they need, there's a lot, you know, you hear about it all the time. Police officers get caught for doing crazy stuff. And it's up to the good officers to weed these officers out. And my father told me about instances he had to tell on a few officers because they really were doing some stuff that he couldn't let, he couldn't sleep at night. So he had to tell on his fellow officers, but by him doing that, he also saved officers' lives, because he, by this officer doing these things, he wasn't just putting prisoners at risk, he was putting other officers at risk.
Right.
So you have to do the right thing and get rid of these cops, these policemen that are rogue ones. Like I said, 75% of policemen are heroes. I couldn't imagine a world without policemen, you know, but it's up to them to get rid of the ones in their ranks who are full of hate and have issues that need to be dealt with.
That's an interesting perspective and a really a nice way to look at it. It's like, you know, by taking part in this whole blue code of silence and allowing police officers to do unethical things, that they're not only putting citizens at risk and communities at risk, but they're putting other officers at risk. And I wonder if that's something that is really, if that's a perspective that is really processed by those people who do take part often in the blue code of silence, you know?
Right.
There was something that was brought up, and I'm kind of skipping around through this, the black and blue dialogue, and I have these notes. There's just kind of handwritten notes that I will post shortly on the K-Hum Facebook page if anyone wants to look at them. And someone had mentioned that one of the students at HSU had mentioned that systematically having cops has been bad for people of color. Do you feel like that's true? Because you're saying, you know, police officers, 75% of them are heroes, and someone's vacuuming me in the background. That's really bugging me. Do you mind closing that door? Sorry, Nate. It's like, why you got a vacuum right now? That's much better. But what do you think about that statement? Do you feel like that has some truth to it, or not? You want to speak to that, Nate? You haven't been saying much.
Can you rephrase the question?
Someone had mentioned, you know, this was a response to a question at the Black and Blue dialogue of how the recent events in the news are affecting people of color. And one of the students had mentioned that he felt like systematically having cops has been bad for people of color throughout history.
Right.
How do you feel about that statement?
That's true. It's very, I mean, you think about Jim Crow era segregation, you know, slavery, all of these things, you know, and the civil rights in the 60s, and that evolved basically into the Black Lives Matter movement now that started with Trayvon Martin, when George Zimmerman, basically a vigilante, was not convicted of murdering a child in his backyard, basically. So that started the Black Lives Matter movement, which is an offshoot of segregation, Jim Crow, and things that we as a people had to fight for, you know, since the Civil War, you know, John Brown to, you know, there's great, great heroes on both sides of the color spectrum. And it's when we came together is when things changed. It's like the Jewish people say, never again. You know, that's when it comes to Jim Crow, segregation, all these things, we can't let it sneak into the policing of America. You know, never again. And we have to have the same attitude as Jewish people and really stand together with all peoples and make sure this does not happen. And Trump is kind of like a Hitler because he's bringing up hate.
I would agree that Trump is definitely, if there has been anything that he has brought up in his campaign, I feel like it has been this idea of hate and then the realization of how much hate exists in our society for these different cultures and races and just, I mean, genders and things. So it does feel like I'm hearing from you. It felt like from the black and blue dialogue that him and this whole presidential campaign has been creating a whole lot more tension,
right?
For people of color in our community. And, you know, I'm trying to think of, is there anything else that we could do in our communities aside from, you know, have more dialogue and to really pay attention to, you know, for police officers to not only be in communities when they're policing, but be part of a community when they're not necessarily on the clock,
yeah,
and interacting with their communities in other ways other than policing them. How do you feel about like the uniform? Does that bring
anxiety
to you?
Of course.
So if you were do you feel like it would be helpful if you were able to see a police officer in your community that sometimes wears a uniform but not necessarily wearing a uniform all the time? Like,
you know,
do you think that would help to make a more human connection in your mind between police and...
I think it would help in our minds and in the police minds, too. It's just a more, you know, on the same level, being equal level. You know, it's all about equilibrium. And if we could, people could meet, you know, a middle point and feel equal to each other, you know, as a sense of human to human. You know, we both live, we both die, we were both babies, we both couldn't die alone. So, you know, we have to have these human-to-human interactions and realize that color is just the color, you know?
It's literally melanin. It's like, that's all it is. And I mean, and I will say, there's culture that is associated, because everyone, you know, there's my fiance, he's Mexican, and he definitely brings, you know, a Latin culture, Latino culture. And so there are culture that is associated with color, but I think too frequently we maybe make those connections between color and culture and not understanding culture,
right,
and associating it with color instead of just seeing color as like a pigment.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
And maybe, you know, having more different cultural experiences within our community, like doing more cultural things that represent all different cultures. I'm a square dance caller. I mean, that's white culture right there. We have square dances all the time, but I don't really see, I mean, and I know that some of the Native American communities, they have, they do cultural things and they invite the community to take part and witness their ceremonies and to celebrate, you know, the salmon. And so reaching out, different cultures maybe reaching out to the community and kind of showing the vibrance that they add to the community through their culture.
Yes, that would be great. Interactions, you know, it's just a disconnect that allows these things to happen. For, you know, a black man like me to be uncomfortable with speaking to an officer if I needed help. Like, you know, if I really needed help, like, should I go ask him for help? Or will he get threatened, feel threatened by me approaching him? So we need to get rid of those barriers. We need to be approachable, you know? And once we see each other as approachable, not like he's a gangster kid that wants to shoot everything, or he's a killer cop that wants to shoot everything, we have to get rid of that fear. You know?
Yeah. I feel like what I took away from the black and blue dialogue is there was just so much, there is, the underlying thing is fear.
Right.
And fear of the unknown and fear of what's going to happen and fear of not understanding where other people are coming from. So it sounds like we've got a lot of work to do.
We do.
We have a lot of work to do, and I really appreciate both of you. We're talking with D'Angelo Jackson and Nate Jackson, if you're just joining us, and I've been recording this conversation, so I will I apologize for all the vacuuming that's going on. It's driving me crazy. But I will be podcasting this up online too if you want to revisit this conversation. And I invite you, if you have any ideas of what we can do as a community to help and to help solve some of these issues. I think this really affects us here in Humboldt. I think a lot of times people in Humboldt don't necessarily see it as much, so they don't think that it's here, but racism exists here. You know, the police and people of color within our own community are experiencing this friction, and it's something that we really all need to address together. So thanks you guys so much.
Very welcome. Thank you
for coming and talking. Us. Yeah, thanks for coming and talking, and I'll always stay in touch and let me know if you have any awesome ideas.
We will.
About how to solve this thing.
We're going to fix it.
I think so too. I think so too. And you know, I've noticed something, you know, I have a daughter, and I feel like generationally it's only getting better. And I don't know if that seems naive or hopeful, but it seems like through each generation, kids are not with it anymore. They're not with putting these bias on things. And it's something that's getting slowly a little teeny tiny bit better. I wish that it was getting better in bigger chunks, but it seems like generationally we've come a long way in the last few generations.
Slow progress is better than no progress. You know, everything takes time. We planted the seeds. We just have to water it, continue to work it, do what we do now, have dialogue, and just talk about everything.
Cool. Well, thanks again, you guys. You have been listening to KHUM, Humboldt Grown Radio Without the Rules. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we will have some more music for you. So stick around.